So we like to start from host and go to the microbiota and go back, come back to the host side. So we always think like if we are only focusing on these biases and that outcomes, it's very easy to neglect the ecological causes behind the dysbiosis.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organisation, also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today, our guest, we're delighted to be joined by Jian Li from Andres Baumler's lab in the University of California, Davis. And Jian, you're very welcome. And we're here to discuss primarily a really interesting paper that you all published recently in Cell in February. And we put a link to that paper in the show notes for this podcast. Can you tell us first, maybe, how you came to be a scientist in Andres' lab and your background?
Hello, thank you for having me today. My name is Jian and I'm an assistant project scientist in the Dr. Baumler's lab at UC Davis. And I'm originally from South Korea and where I have earned my MD and PhD. Until 2017, I have worked as a family medicine practitioner in South Korea. So while I was working as a clinician, I was participated in many clinical trials and clinical researches. And one of my main research interests was about how gut microbiota and probiotic strains are affecting the health of gastrointestinal disease patients, including colorectal cancer patients and irritable bowel syndrome patients. I wanted to extend my research more mechanistically, and in 2017, I had an opportunity to join Dr. Baumler's lab as a visiting scholar. So I actually supposed to be here only for 2 years and planned to go back to Korea and work as a clinician. But at that time, I fell in love with microbiome and decided to just stay longer. And I'll quit my job in Korea as a clinician and stayed in the Dr. Baumler's lab as a postdoc. And after finishing my postdoc, I'm working as an assistant project scientist now. So currently, my main research interest is how ecological causes like diet or chronic disease conditions can change host cell metabolism, thereby changing gut microbiota, and also exploring the consequence of gut dysbiosis on non-communicable human disease, including inflammatory bowel disease and chronic kidney disease and some other disease.
That's really fascinating history. And did you, when you were in Korea working as a family physician, did you prescribe or recommend probiotics to many of your patients? And if so, for what conditions?
So I was using probiotics for improving some gastrointestinal symptoms of my patients, mostly for irritable bowel syndrome patients. And also I was involved in one clinical trial. So it was about how to improve gastrointestinal symptoms of colorectal cancer survivors. So they have been cleared from their disease. So that's the reason that why they were called cancer survivors. But they were still having some gastrointestinal symptoms like diarrhea or bloating or abdominal pains. And it's not related with their disease directly, maybe related to their surgical condition or some other stuff. So I was involved in the clinical trial giving probiotic strains and to see whether their symptoms are improved, and actually it was working. So in the research and also in the clinics, I was involved in probiotic strains. Yeah.
And this paper that we want to discuss today, it, as I said, published in Cell just very recently, involves another gastrointestinal condition of sorbitol intolerance. Can you tell us something about sorbitol and sorbitol intolerance, how it manifests itself in patients?
So sorbitol is a type of sugar alcohol, and it is widely used as an artificial sweetener. And the main reason that it is used as an artificial sweetener is because it's sweet, and also our human gut cells, small intestinal cells, cannot absorb or transport and catabolize sorbitol, so we cannot use it as a calorie. So which means what if we are intaking sorbitol, they will arrive in our large intestine mostly, and potentially can draw water inside the lumen through osmosis. So that means if we are like intaking large amounts of sorbitol, everybody will have some GI symptoms like diarrhea. But most people, if we are not taking large amounts of sorbitol at the same time, we are pretty tolerable on sorbitol. But there are a specific group of patients or people who are more sensitive to sorbitol intake. So if in that case, even they are intaking like 3 grams or 5 grams of sorbitol, they can suffer from GI symptoms such as diarrhea. And we don't know why, because sorbitol intolerance is a little bit different with other types of carbohydrate intolerance. For example, lactose intolerance is the most common carbohydrate intolerance. In that case, most people can absorb lactose from their small intestine, but some people are lack of enzyme which can absorb and catabolize lactose. But in case of sorbitol, nobody can actually absorb and catabolize sorbitol, which means it will all reach into the large intestine. That means not the host cells, but something is involved in developing sorbitol intolerance. And it is already well known that many bacteria can catabolize sorbitol, unlike our host cells. And using enzyme sorbitol dehydrogenase, they can convert sorbitol into the fructose. So that kind of known factors actually drove us to think that maybe gut bacteria is the main cause determine whether we are tolerable or intolerable to sorbitol. And that's the reason that we start our study.
And you were able to show through an interesting series of experiments, Jian, that sometimes people are only temporarily able to not tolerate sorbitol. Can you talk about the sequence of exposures that you use first with antibiotics to show that the sorbitol intolerance can be transient? And then if you combine that with a high-fat diet, what do you find?
Yes. So when we are intaking antibiotics for the treatment of our condition, many people actually experience diarrhea. And there are like a couple of mechanisms involved in antibiotics-induced diarrhea. And actually, sorbitol or other sugar alcohol-induced diarrhea is one of the mechanisms why we are experiencing diarrhea after intaking antibiotics. So when we are intaking antibiotics and our gut microbiota is transiently disrupted, and then sorbitol or other sugar alcohols, which can be supplemented through our diet, cannot be catabolized by this bacteria. So through osmotic pressure, diarrhea can be happened transiently. But as we already know, that antibiotics-induced microbiota disruption can be recovered pretty fastly. Because we used mouse model, it was faster than human because they are coprophagic. So when we are checking a day after giving antibiotics and giving sorbitol, they were susceptible to sorbitol and they developed sorbitol intolerance. But this symptom only sustained 5 days. So when we are giving sorbitol 5 days after giving antibiotics, they are not intolerant to sorbitol anymore. So this means that this antibiotic-induced sorbitol intolerance phenomenon cannot explain sustained sorbitol intolerance, which some of the patients are experiencing. So they are experiencing sorbitol intolerance all the time, not only right after their antibiotics treatment. So we thought we need a better mouse model to study sustained sorbitol intolerance. And that's the reason why we used a high-fat diet and antibiotics combination mouse model. So actually, this model is from our previous paper. So previously, when I was working as a clinician, I've been lucky to collect some patient fecal samples and also data. And these patients had irritable bowel syndrome symptoms. And also, I've been collecting some samples from healthy volunteers. And at first, my focus was irritable bowel syndrome. But I found that when I was measuring fecal calprotectin level, a biomarker of colon inflammation, surprisingly, there was a subgroup of patients with irritable bowel syndrome symptoms have higher fecal calprotectin levels. So it was unexpected because irritable bowel syndrome is a functional bowel disease, so they are not supposed to have any gut inflammation. And also they've never been diagnosed with IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, and their colonoscopy was clean, which placed them into the gray zone between IBS and IBD. And when I was checking their ecological factors and found that high-fat diet and a history of antibiotics within 1 year was related with this low-grade colon inflammation with GI symptoms. So I wanted to find more like mechanism that are connecting these ecological causes and colon inflammation. And at that point, I joined Dr. Baumler's lab and I could develop a mouse model using these two ecological causes, high-fat diet and antibiotics treatment, and found that actually this mouse model recapitulates most of the phenotypes that I have found from patient samples. So they developed low-grade colon inflammation. One of the most fascinating things that I thought was they have same patterns of dysbiosis. So they have a lower relative abundance of obligate anaerobic bacteria such as Clostridia, and they have higher relative abundance of facultative anaerobic bacteria. And also this dysbiotic pattern was sustained for the whole experimental period. So I was thinking that maybe by using this mouse model, we can study sorbitol intolerance better. And when we are challenging this mouse model with sorbitol, we found that mice developed a sorbitol intolerance even 4 weeks after giving antibiotics treatment.
And where is the main source of sorbitol in the diet? Is it people drinking lots of diet sodas or things like that? Or where are the main sources that people might encounter sorbitol?
So sorbitol is actually in the natural ingredients too. For example, many fruits have sorbitol like apricot or apple or avocados. These kind of natural ingredients are natural sources are including sorbitol. But actually the amount is very small. But the larger amount can be found in product with artificial sweeteners. So for example, like gummy bears, sugar-free gummy bears, or sugar-free gum, this kind of stuff, we can see sorbitol as an ingredient.
And then the connection with the high-fat diet, is it always that people on a very high-fat diet tend to, well, you can imagine they tend towards obesity, but could lean people even on a high-fat diet still be sorbitol intolerant?
So we didn't check the correlation between body weight and sorbitol intolerance. But one thing that I can say is in many keto diets, they usually contain higher fat contents and low carbohydrate contents. And because they want to reduce carbohydrate contents, they sometimes use artificial sweeteners like sugar alcohols, like sorbitol. So that kind of diet can be related with sorbitol intolerance. So I guess maybe even they are not obese, there might be a portion of people who are consuming high fat and high protein with a higher amount of sorbitol or other artificial sweeteners.
Well, you had also mentioned like the role potentially of inflammation in the gut. And earlier you talked about, you know, treating cancer patients. Your team has also published a really terrific review article in Science that talks about the role of the host in influencing what happens in the colon. And I wonder if you feel like this experiment kind of gives some potential insight into that, the fact that you could have diarrhea resulting from the host inability to tightly control the availability of oxygen and nitrogen in the colon.
Yes, so we like to start from host and go to the microbiota and come back to the host side. So we always think like if we are only focusing on dysbiosis and that outcomes, it's very easy to neglect the ecological causes behind the dysbiosis. So in this mouse model, for example, in this our project, the ecological causes of dysbiosis was high-fat diet and a combination with antibiotics treatment. We found that high-fat diet can directly inhibit mitochondrial function of colon epithelium and reduce the oxygen consumption of mitochondria. And also antibiotics treatment can do the same thing indirectly. So by depleting butyrate producer, and because butyrate producer is colon epithelial PPAR gamma agonist, and then also enhancing mitochondrial oxygen consumption. So when we are combining these two ecological causes and colon epithelial mitochondrial function was depleted chronically, and as a result, our colon environment became less hypoxic. And that was the reason why Clostridia their depletion was sustained when we are combining high-fat diet with antibiotics treatment, because streptomycin treatment depleted obligate anaerobic bacteria such as Clostridia, and it is very sensitive to oxygen. So when gut environment was not hypoxic anymore, there was a delayed recovery of them. And as a result, there was a sustained Clostridia depletion. And as a result of sustained Clostridia depletion, sorbitol intolerance was the outcome, because through our 16S ribosomal analysis and metagenomic analysis, we further found that Clostridia actually is the main bacteria responsible for catabolizing sorbitol in our gut. So we thought focusing on ecological causes as a starting point, just focusing on these biases, then we cannot see the whole picture. And that's how we approach this project.
What I really love about the paper, Gian, and the approach that you used was you made this fascinating correlation that you just described, the association between antibiotic treatment, depletion of Clostridia, and then sorbitol intolerance. But then you actually designed an intervention that I think will interest a lot of our listeners, because they're interested in probiotics and prebiotics. And the intervention was, of course, various different probiotics. Can you tell us how you selected those probiotics and the impact of administering probiotics in this model?
So we tested three potential probiotic strains. So first, we chose E. coli Nissl 1917. The reason that we chose E. coli Nissl is it is widely used as a probiotics and also have some effect on IBD patients. And quiescent IBD patients, actually quiescent IBD patients are known to be more susceptible to sorbitol intolerance. So we wanted to see whether E. coli Nissl can additionally help them for developing and preventing from developing sorbitol intolerance. And also we chose L. plantarum because it's widely used as a probiotic strain and also can catabolize sorbitol. And the third probiotic candidate was a little bit unusual one. It was an Aneurostaps kake. So it is actually not currently used as a probiotic strain in the market, but it is a human isolated Clostridia strain. We thought because Clostridia is the main bacteria responsible for catabolizing sorbitol in the gut, and also the missing Clostridia was the main reason for sorbitol intolerance. So we thought it is reasonable to choose one Clostridia strain and to test as a probiotic strain. So we tested E. coli Nissl and L. plantarum and Aneurostaps kake. When we are testing these three strains using our high-fat diet and antibiotics treatment mouse model, we found that 3 days after supplementation, all strains were effectively protect the host from developing sorbitol intolerance. But surprisingly, when we are checking them in a longer period at day seven, the effect of L. plantarum was not present anymore. So we wanted to know the reason, and we found that actually when you're checking the colonization of L. plantarum, it was lower at day seven, so which explained why it was not working anymore. But I thought it doesn't mean that L. plantarum is not a good candidate, because in real world, we are like supplementing probiotics daily basis, but in the mouse model, we just supplemented them once. So if they are supplemented every day, I'm pretty sure that they were still working. But in this model, so L. plantar, this suggests that colonization is important for protecting the host from sorbitol intolerance. But another thing that we found that when you're also checking the colonization of Aneurostaps kake strain, we were expecting higher colonization. But at day seven, even it was effectively protecting the host from sorbitol intolerance, their colonization level was decreased almost down to the detection limit of detection, which means Aneurostaps kake was mostly cleared out at day seven, but still working, which means Aneurostaps kake is not protecting the host from developing sorbitol intolerance. Some other bacteria might be. So we wanted to find the mechanism, how it's still working after it's being cleared out. One of the characteristics of Aneurostaps kake different with L. plantarum or E. coli is it's a butyrate producer. And as I've mentioned earlier, butyrate is a PPAR gamma agonist and has a potential to improve colon environment. So we hypothesized that maybe Aneurostaps kake at day three can catabolize sorbitol by themselves, but maybe at day 7, they produce butyrate and enhance mitochondrial oxygen consumption in the colon epithelium, thereby changing the gut environment hypoxic again and enhancing the recovery of other depleted Clostridia, which can potentially catabolize sorbitol naturally. And we check this hypothesis by checking oxygenation of colon epithelium and whether unearthed Staphylococcus is really helping the recovery of other Clostridia strains, and found that that was true. So we found that actually unearthed Staphylococcus is working as probiotics in two different mechanisms. First, by directly catabolizing sorbitol, and secondly, by enhancing colon environment, thereby recovering other missing bacteria and helping them to recover their homeostasis.
Yeah, it really sounds like the ideal intervention. It comes in and directly helps with the problem, but then it also enhances the restoration of homeostasis. Let's make clear that you tested each of these candidate strains in isolation. You did not use a cocktail approach, right? Each one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a remarkably elegant study. I mean, it moves from building logic on logic on logic and reaching a very satisfying conclusion. So congratulations on that. What do you think? I mean, I was still a little bit fascinated by how you came up with Anaerostypes cacae. I mean, where did that come from? Was it one that was already grown routinely in the lab? Did you select it out of somebody's microbiota? I'm just fascinated by where you came up with that particular strain.
So one of the reasons that we chose Anaerostypes cacae strain is because when we are checking fecal microbiota of healthy people from the feces that I've collected from healthy volunteers, and Anaerostypes cacae is one of the most common Clostridia strain that healthy people are sharing. So it's hard to say that it's just one cohort of samples. So it's hard to say that it's a kind of biomarker of a healthy microbiome, but it looks like it is very common gut microbiota in the human. And also in our lab, we have 17 Clostridia strains. This was from Honda lab in Japan. And they already have shown that they can produce short-chain fatty acid, and it is very important in our immune system regulation. So since we have that strain and we found that it's very common in our human microbiota, so we thought it is worth to try. And also one of the most important factors is a sorbitol catabolizer. Not all Clostridia can catabolize sorbitol, but Anaerostypes cacae can have sorbitol dehydrogenase and can catabolize sorbitol.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to see, you know, a genetic knockout, an isogenic knockout, which cannot catabolize sorbitol as a control. It would be wonderful to see whether that would work. A huge challenge, I guess, for developing a Clostridia as a potential probiotic would be the regulation. So have you even scoped out what the regulators might think of using this microbe as a probiotic that people would administer along with antibiotics or immediately after antibiotic treatment?
So we are also thinking that it will be really challenging. So I haven't checked the regulation exactly, but yes, I think it will be really challenging because many people think even Clostridia is one of our human gut's main bacteria, but it's also some Clostridia strains are potential pathogens. So I don't think it will be easy.
You also found you had an interesting hypothesis that reduced sorbitol dehydrogenase activity could be a potential biomarker, and you had some nice experimental evidence to substantiate that. I wondered if you wanted to comment a little bit on the role of that as a biomarker or other potential biomarkers that we maybe should concentrate on in developing therapies.
Yeah, so currently even like in clinics, even like doctors think the patients have sorbitol intolerance or other sugar alcohol intolerance, there is no way for diagnosis. So the only way to diagnosis currently is try to avoid certain type of carbohydrate and to see whether the symptom is getting better or not. So it's not very straightforward and it's also challenging. So we thought if we can measure sorbitol dehydrogenase activity using feces, then that means that the microbial sorbitol dehydrogenase activity And it's supposed to be decreased because we found that decreased microbial sorbitol dehydrogenase activity is related with the development of sorbitol intolerance. So we first measure sorbitol dehydrogenase activity using the cecal contents from the mouse that we used and found that HIFA diet and strep treatment mice, their sorbitol dehydrogenase activity in the cecal contents was markedly decreased. So using this result, we wanted to see whether it can be potentially used in the clinics. So using the patient fecal samples, we measure sorbitol dehydrogenase activity in the feces and found that actually there was a decreased microbial fecal sorbitol dehydrogenase activity with the patients with high fat diet and antibiotics treatment. And also, but it doesn't mean that they do have sorbitol intolerance. So we wanted, or we further like survey whether there is a patient who are developing GI symptoms when they are intaking artificial sweeteners. And patients with intolerance of artificial sweeteners showed lower sorbitol dehydrogenase activity, which suggests that this biomarker might can be used as for the diagnosis of sorbitol intolerance. And one good thing about this enzyme is the name of enzyme is sorbitol intolerance, but this enzyme also can catabolize other sugar alcohols like xylitol or mannitol. So it can be more like generally used for using sugar alcohol intolerance, not just sorbitol.
Well, Dr. Lee, I thank you so much for sharing this paper. I encourage anyone listening to this to go and read the paper. It is constructed so beautifully and it flows so well. Fantastic study. Congratulations again, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.